This is an ABC podcast.
This is ABC Australia Wide on ABC Radio.
Bang, 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 bang. Six fantastic sonic booms. The doors rattled and the wardrobe doors and the windows, and we raced outside.
40 years on, we remember the night Skylab space station came crashing back down to Earth. And we meet a young Townsville Elvis impersonator.
Are you lonesome tonight?
It's just a lot of practice, really. You know, I listen to a lot of interviews with Elvis and try to copy what he does, and I do that before I go on stage, so it sort of gets into character a little bit.
Could Brody Finlay be cast as the King in Baz Luhrmann's new biopic? Those stories and more. I'm Alex Simon, and this is Australia Wide. First to the Gold Coast tonight, to the Earlhaven Retirement Village that dramatically shut down yesterday, leaving scores of vulnerable elderly residents in limbo. It's been a frantic 24 hours for authorities, residents and their families as they've worked to make new arrangements for more than 70 elderly people, many of whom have dementia. Elise Kinsella has been at Earlhaven. Elise, what happened there last night?
Look, the scenes that have been described to us really are awful and nearly unbelievable. So what we understand is that a 000 call was put in just before 2 o'clock yesterday afternoon when emergency services did arrive at the nursing home. What they found was elderly people, people who were bedridden, some with dementia, quite vulnerable people who were there without any paid staff to look after them. There wasn't food. There wasn't medication. Their medication and medical records had been removed. So a really drastic situation that's been described to us as chaotic and traumatic, and which has been described by the Queensland Health Minister, Stephen Miles, as a health emergency.
So why has it come to this, Elise?
So what we understand is this is a dispute over a contract. So the owner of the or the operator of this nursing home is a company called PeopleCare. Its owner, Arthur Miller, has put out a statement. He said that he cancelled a contract with a company called Help Street that was the contractor that was running the services at this nursing home. He said that contract was cancelled on Monday. There was meant to be a 30-day transition period where he would get in a new contractor. He said that Help Street didn't have the correct insurance and that he'd had complaints from workers and families of residents there about how they were operating the place. That, of course, has been disputed by Help Street. It told the ABC yesterday that the operator hadn't guaranteed it funding and that it therefore couldn't guarantee that it could pay staff. So somewhere in there is what exactly went on, and that will form the investigations that you would think that the Commonwealth and state governments are talking about starting.
What's been the reaction from the families of those residents?
The families are really upset, as you can imagine. These are quite elderly and vulnerable people who are not always in the best of health. I did speak to Lorraine Cook. Her husband, John, had been living in this nursing home. She spoke to me and was just really upset. She said her husband wasn't moved until late into last night, that she saw a lot of distressed residents. And I think we have a few seconds of Lorraine speaking.
You know, at 11 o'clock they took him to the other nursing home, and going from a nice room on his own, he's in a bed and he's in a room with six or eight people.
Were you concerned about his health during all of this?
Yes, there was a few taken to hospital because they had chest pains and they were all anxious and upset.
That's Lorraine Cook, the wife of Earlhaven resident John. Queensland Health Minister Stephen Miles is calling for a Commonwealth investigation into the incident. Elise, what else has he had to say today?
Stephen Miles was visibly moved by what had happened when he spoke today. You could see that he was really upset that residents had been left in this position. What he said is that the police will be looking into this. He was particularly concerned about the state that this building was in when emergency services arrived. And here he is describing that.
There is no excuse for just walking out on them. There is no excuse for taking their patient records, no excuse for taking their pharmaceuticals, for taking their mop buckets, for taking the gloves that staff would use to help them toilet and shower.
That's Queensland Health Minister Stephen Miles. And just finally, Elise, what's been the reaction from the Federal Health Minister to this?
Yeah, we have had a statement released from the Federal Aged Care Minister, Richard Colbeck, this afternoon. What he has said is that it appears the subcontractor withdrew services without notice. He said there will be an investigation into what exactly has gone on. So, you know, it looks like there will be a number of people really probing what happened here and how we ended up in a situation where there's more than 70 elderly people who are essentially have to be moved from their homes at very little notice late at night because of a financial dispute. So definitely lots of questions left unanswered at this stage.
Elise Kinsella, thanks for joining Australia Wide.
Thanks.
And the timing of this issue at the Earl Haven Retirement Village is interesting, with the Aged Care Royal Commission heading to Queensland next week. Here is the Queensland Health Minister, Stephen Miles, in regards to that.
There is a Royal Commission into aged care looking at some of the questions that need to be asked about this facility. They are in Queensland next week, and I expect that they will have an interest in what exactly has gone on here.
Staying with the Aged Care Royal Commission, and 5 days of hearings have concluded in Darwin today. Matt Garrick has been there. Matt, testimony in the last 2 days has focused on the territory. What have we heard?
Yes, it has, Alex. After a couple of days of pretty damning evidence from aged care centres in New South Wales, Victoria and Queensland, we've now turned the spotlight back to the Northern Territory. We've had some direct evidence given today from a witness who has expressed concern of her father's treatment at an aged care facility in Darwin. She hasn't named the facility, but there aren't many aged care facilities in the top end capital. So look, it's quite interesting. She says her father she's basically alleged over medication. She said she's had times where she's visited the centre and found her father soaked in urine. Another occasion she went there and there was dried blood on his face that none of the staff had allegedly not cleaned up from him. She said he's deteriorated very rapidly, his health. He was only put in there in December last year, and she says since then he's hardly out of bed. He's really aggressive on his drugs, and sometimes he's just sedated on these strong drugs that they've been giving him. She was very tearful, the witness. Her name was Joanne Lovegrove, and she was quite emotionally stricken by the end of today's evidence when she was describing how this man was a once fit, active and kind gentleman who's basically been left bedridden and lonely.
So what are the main issues then to come out of this for those in the territory?
Oh, look, the tyranny of distance was a big one. You know, the having to leave your home to go and find aged care resources, having in some instances to go 800 kilometres where you're so far away from your family, and for Aboriginal families that are very close and to have to leave that country that has the connection to the spiritual connection as well. It was just heartbreaking, some of those stories. Look, also, is the same as all around the country. The stories that we're hearing from Darwin are of alleged neglect, of cases of indignity, people just falling through the cracks.
The Royal Commission now heads to Cairns next week. Matt Garrick, thanks for speaking to Australia Wide.
Thanks so much.
You're listening to ABC Australia Wide.
With me, Alex Hyman. Now, it's been 4 decades since NASA's first ever space station plummeted to Earth, scattering debris across a town in WA. The event sparked international media attention and made Esperance part of space history. Parts of the Skylab station are now kept in the town's museum as a reminder of the bizarre event. Reporter Isabel Massali has this story.
When it happened, some had stayed up past midnight hoping they'd see the most spectacular light show. But others were fast asleep, thinking the piece of space history was in the ocean.
It was coming over the toe of South Africa, and then it was over a bit further over into the Indian Ocean, then a bit more and a bit more, and they were going to try and bring it down in the Southern Ocean. And then at 10:30, they said, "It's all over, you can go to bed, it's down in the Indian Ocean, Southern Ocean. So we packed up, went home. A lot of people were going up to Wireless Hill to watch it go over, and I said, "Well, you're wasting your time, it's socked in anyway."
After 6 years in orbit, NASA's first and now abandoned space station was going off course. The space agency was nervously tracking its path to Earth, and when it finally crash-landed in WA southeast, it caught locals off guard, including the former Esperance Shire president, Merv Andre.
Bang, 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 bang. Six fantastic sonic booms. The doors rattled and the wardrobe doors and the windows, and we raced outside, saw nothing. It was all over. But the people who were up on Wireless Hill, the cloud had disappeared. They had a perfect view of this thing breaking up into 1,000 pieces. And they were very worried that some of those bits might come down and hit them. It was a couple of people were laying flat on the ground.
We were just sipping the last of our coffee, and we were startled by some sonic booms. So we all rushed out, the four of us rushed out onto the veranda on the eastern side of the house, and there it was. Clear sky, no cloud. We watched this fiery apparition rocketing through the sky. It was the best fireworks display you would ever see, followed by sonic booms. It was only a matter of seconds that we had to view it because of the speed it was travelling at.
That was Brendan Freeman, a farmer at the time who's one of a lucky few to see the Skylab station crash. With some debris being as big as a car, many say it's miraculous no one was hurt.
Nothing was hurt, and it was marvellous. We had one councillor that wanted to make a big noise all over the world about it, but we said, "Look, no damage is done, so let's ride it over," and we got marvellous publicity out of it.
Within days, a team of NASA officials arrived to assess the scene and answer many questions from the Australian press.
It was our hope, and I'll repeat it, that we would never see it again and it would land in the ocean.
Would you agree that if Skylab had crashed on the American continent, it could have been disastrous for the American space program?
No, I wouldn't agree with that. Obviously, if it impacts on any landmass, it would have a problem. But I think it's worth noting in this context that when reentry started, 48 hours before this thing came in, it was on a track or a series of orbits that really had the least risk to human life.
Meanwhile, the race was on to find pieces of debris scattered across the region. Some were kept for souvenirs, others sold off. And a newspaper called the San Francisco Examiner was offering $10,000 to the first person to return a piece to the US. The winner, a 17-year-old boy.
They took us into the San Francisco Examiner and left us there with Jeff Jarvis and the San Francisco crew. All took off from there. They put it all in a security case and everything and sent it off to San Diego to get checked out. They had NASA bot there somewhere. Following Thursday, there was authentic pieces of Skylab.
The Shire of Esperance was hoping to cash in too, issuing a $400 fine to NASA for littering. But the real benefit was the international publicity. Qantas executives told an American TV station Skylab did one good thing. It reminded the world that there's such a place as Australia.
People were ringing from all over the world at 2 o'clock and 3 o'clock in the morning, but I don't know that it actually changed Esperance, but we have used it shamelessly for publicity, and we've got it all over the place, and it was a pretty wonderful thing to happen.
Well, I can certainly say that Skylab did put Esperance on the map. It also put a few other places in around regional WA on the map as well. But we do like to say that we have a very comprehensive display of Skylab debris here at the museum, which still brings people to Esperance specifically just to see what we have. And the comments that we have about our display is remarkable, and it's great to have people coming to visit.
Linda Horn from the Esperance Museum says 40 years on, the story of Skylab's crash still captures the curiosity of tourists and historians. After the town's anniversary celebrations this week, she hopes some have learnt Skylab is more than just a bizarre story, which could have ended in catastrophe.
For a lot of us here in Esperance, it just came crashing down in our backyard, whereas there was a bigger purpose to Skylab, and I guess we hope that through the Skylab 40th anniversary program, we can help provide a little bit of education about its purpose and the impact that it made, especially towards the partnership to get the International Space Station to what we have today.
Isabel Musali with that report there from Esperance.
You're listening to Australia Wide.
It's a species that I have been fighting for.
Growing up in the bush is such a special thing.
So when the rain does come, we've got a few numbers.
What
got
if
a...
it never comes?
Put a feather in your cap.
ABC Radio.
This is Australia Wide. You're with Alex Hyman. The theme of NAIDOC Week this year is Voice, Treaty, Truth. Well, two young boxers from Victoria's Latrobe Valley have found their voice through the sport of boxing. The brother and sister duo is representing Victoria in the Golden Gloves competition in New Zealand next week. 17-year-old Sugar Cherie Porter and her 16-year-old brother, Will the Kadachi Kid, train four times a week at the Moi Youth Club, and they get very strong support from their parents. Will says boxing has turned his life around. Jonathan Kendall has the story.
They're as good as anyone I've ever seen. Undoubtedly they're as good, if not better. Natural talent is there, but natural talent's not enough. It also comes down to desire.
That's Paul Jenkins. He's coached many boxers through the Moi Youth Club over many years, and he's a big rap for Will and Cherie Porter. Their training schedule is tough. Skipping, bags, pads, sparring, it's non-stop and really demanding. And it's also got Will Porter on the right path.
I was just hanging out with like the wrong people that got in trouble with the cops all the time and stuff like that. And now, since I started boxing, it's just completely different. And my life, like the whole lifestyle's completely different. I like eat different, and I like just everything's different. Boxing really disciplines you with what you do outside and inside the gym.
Will's mum and dad are proud Kamilaroi people from New South Wales. His dad, Neil, says boxing has been a revelation for Will.
I thought it would make him worse at school, wanting to fight and all like that, but it's sort of made him more respectful and know where you put fight. You don't put it in front of your eyes or in your first thing in your head. He sort of put that back for the sport, and that's where it sits, and he doesn't hang out with them kids no more, and it's changed him a lot.
And he's glad the racism that he experienced as a kid doesn't seem to be as severe these days.
In my days, we were tormented a lot, picked on a lot, but now I see that doesn't happen now. Not like when we were at school, we get called names and that. I don't see that today. It's like they're all getting along together.
The boxing bug has also bitten 17-year-old Cherie, who's also fighting in New Zealand next week.
It's not really about if I win or not, more showing everyone what I can do and the skills I have, everyone to know my name.
Both kids wear their NAIDOC Week T-shirts at training, emblazoned with this year's theme, Voice, Treaty, Truth. Their dad couldn't be prouder of the next generation of Indigenous knowledge holders.
It's them fellas that are going to be left with it all. We're going to teach them, and it gets handed down to them, because then the elders go out and then they become elders in their time.
For Cherie, this year's theme is all about equality.
Letting everyone's voices be heard, everyone treated equal and how they deserve to be treated.
That 17-year-old Sugar Cherie Porter and her 16-year-old brother Will the Kadachi Kid telling Jonathan Kendall about how boxing has changed their lives.
ABC Australia Wide.
You're with Alex Hyman, and finally tonight on Australia Wide, when Baz Luhrmann announced he was on the hunt for an actor to play Elvis Presley in a forthcoming biopic, there was a lot of excitement and speculation as to who might slip on the blue suede shoes. 23-year-old Townsville law student Brodie Finlay remained cool, even after receiving a call from Luhrmann's office. Mr. Finlay is one of Australia's top Elvis tribute artists, having won both the Parkes Elvis Music Festival and Viva Surfers Paradise Elvis tribute competitions. Our reporter, Natalie Fernbach, caught up with Mr. Finlay ahead of his return to the stage at Viva Surfers Paradise this weekend.
Could a Townsville legal student be the next silver screen Elvis?
You ain't to know.
23-year-old Brody Finlay was crowned top Elvis tribute artist at the Parks Elvis Music Festival this year. He took out Viva Surfers Paradise last year, and he's on Baz Luhrmann's radar.
I got a call about the Baz Luhrmann film, and I was surprised because I didn't audition for it or anything. They just said they think I'd be very good for the young years of Elvis's life part, and it'd be something they'd like to consider.
Are you lonesome tonight? Do you miss me tonight? Are you sorry we drifted apart?
Brody's love of Elvis started at the age of 7, as his mum Leanne Finlay recalls.
Well, we went to a friend's house when Brody was 7, and they were watching an Elvis movie. And Brody just became hooked then. And then when he was 10, we went and saw another Elvis tribute artist. And Brody actually said then, I'm going to be an Elvis impersonator, is what he said. Didn't think it had happened because he really couldn't sing. But, he put all the hard work in, and he used to sit in his room and he used to sing and sing and sing.
When I kissed you and called you sweet.
Elvis fans can get very passionate about the King. Brody says they expect a lot of their tribute artists, and he takes the role very seriously.
They're big shoes to fill. So even though he's been gone a long time, a lot of people know him and know his stuff very well. So, you're sort of kept to a very high standard. So making sure that everything is, up to scratch and how it was originally, that's probably the hardest thing.
Can you tell me a little bit more detail about getting the voice right? How do you do that?
It's just a lot of practice, really. I listen to a lot of interviews with Elvis and try to copy what he does, and I do that before I go on stage, so it sort of gets into character a little bit. But it's just really studying him to every part of his life.
So Elvis being a little bit darker than I am, I've got to make myself quite dark. There's a lot of work involved because Elvis, when you speak to anyone that's ever actually met Elvis and has been around him, which I've met a few of the people, they say, guys and girls have said it, he's a very beautiful man to look at in person. And to recreate that
is quite important.
Why do you do it? Of all the sort of career paths to choose, an Elvis impersonator, why?
I sort of fell into it. It's something I wanted to do, but I didn't plan to do it, if that makes sense. I fell into it because I was in a live band, and it sort of went from there. I started singing, and my voice developed to be a bit more like Elvis's. Why I do what I do specifically, because I specify in the younger years of Elvis's life, and it's something that Australia really doesn't have. Australia doesn't have a lot of the younger versions of Elvis. They're all in a jumpsuit. So I sort of do what I do to sort of show people a different side to Elvis, because everyone knows Elvis in a jumpsuit, but people aren't very familiar with Elvis in his younger years. So I like to do that just to, open people's eyes to what else is out there.
And the hazards of being an Elvis tribute performer? Well, there's being pulled off the stage by adoring fans. Brody Finlay says he always has to carry a spare pair of pants.
Well, for people that know Elvis in the 50s, they know he's very charismatic and he was very raw and moved a lot on stage. It was from sliding across the floor on his knees to, just doing all the moves out there, and quite often enough, you're doing a move and, something happens and you need to replace your pants, so yeah.
You ain't no friend of mine.
Natalie Fernbach there with Townsville Elvis tribute artist Brody Finlay. And Brody will return to the stage at Viva Surfers Paradise this weekend. And he has been told Baz Luhrmann will be in the audience. Could Brody play a young Elvis in Luhrmann's upcoming film? Let's hope so. And if you want to see him in action, head to ABC North Queensland. I'm Alex Hyman. Thanks so much for your company this week. I'll be back again on Monday. All the best.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.